Section 3, New Approaches to Civil Rights. An American Story. In 1968, Vernon and Clyde Bellacourt, along with other Native Americans in Minneapolis, were struggling to earn a living. The Bellacourts decided to take a stand against their conditions. Spurred by the 1960s protest movements and by reawakened pride in their culture, the brothers helped organize the American Indian Movement, or AIM. AIM's goal was to combat discrimination and brutality by the local police. Vernon recalled how AIM worked. They got a small grant from the Urban League of Minneapolis to put two-way radios in their cars and to get tape recorders and cameras. They would listen to the police calls, and when they heard that police were being dispatched to a certain community or bar, they'd show up with cameras and take pictures of the police using more than normal restraint on people. AIM would show up and have attorneys ready. Often they would beat the police back to the station. They would have a bondsman there, and they'd start filing lawsuits against the police department. Quoted in Native American Testimony. Fighting for greater opportunity. At a time of heightened protest in the United States, Native Americans began raising their voices for reform and change. Other groups did as well. During the 1960s and early 1970s, Hispanic Americans organized to improve their status in society. In the wake of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., African Americans continued their fight for greater civil rights, now focusing more on access to jobs. Affirmative action. By the end of the 1960s, many African American leaders expressed a growing sense of frustration. Although most legal forms of racial discrimination had been dismantled, many African Americans felt there had been little improvement in their daily lives. In the eyes of leading civil rights activists, the problems facing most African Americans lay in their lack of access to good jobs and adequate schooling. As a result, leaders of the civil rights movement began to focus their energies on these problems. As part of their effort, civil rights leaders looked to an initiative known as affirmative action. Enforced through executive orders and federal policies, affirmative action called for companies and institutions doing business with the federal government to actively recruit African American employees with the hope that this would lead to improved social and economic status. Officials later expanded affirmative action to include other minority groups and women. Supporters of the policy argued that because so few companies hired from these groups in the past, they had had little chance to develop necessary job skills. If businesses opened their doors wider to minorities, more of them could begin building better lives. In one example of affirmative action's impact, Atlanta witnessed a significant increase in minority job opportunities shortly after Maynard Jackson became its first African-American mayor in 1973. When Jackson took office, less than 1% of all city contracts went to African-Americans, even though they made up about half of Atlanta's population. Jackson used the expansion of the city's airport to redress this imbalance by opening the bidding process for airport contracts more widely to minority firms. Through his efforts, small companies and minority firms took on 25% of all airport construction work, earning them some $125 million in contracts. Challenges to affirmative action. Affirmative action programs did not go unchallenged. Critics viewed them as a form of reverse discrimination. They claimed that qualified white workers were kept from jobs, promotions, and a place in schools because a certain number of such positions had been set aside for minorities or women. One of the more notable attacks on affirmative action came in 1974, after officials at the University of California Medical School at Davis turned down the admission of a white applicant named Alan Bake for a second time. When Bake learned that slots had been set aside for minorities, he sued the school. Bake argued that by admitting minority applicants, some of whom had scored lower than Bake on their exams, the school had discriminated against him due to his race. In 1978, in University of California Regents versus Bake, the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 ruling, declared that the university had indeed violated Bake's rights. On the other hand, it ruled that schools could use racial criteria as part of their admissions process, so long as they did not use fixed quotas. While Bake was not a strong and definitive ruling, the court had nevertheless supported affirmative action programs as constitutional. Equal access to education. By the early 1970s, African American leaders also had begun to push harder for educational improvements. In the 1954 case of Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, the Supreme Court had ordered an end to segregated public schools. In the 1960s, however, many schools remained segregated as local communities moved slowly to comply with the court. Since children normally went to neighborhood public schools, segregation in schooling reflected the race segregation of neighborhoods. White schools were usually far superior to African American schools, as Ruth Baston of the NAACP noted in 1965 after visiting Boston schools. When we would go to white schools, we'd see these lovely classrooms with a small number of children in each class. The teachers were permanent. We'd see wonderful materials. When we'd go to our schools, we'd see overcrowded classrooms, children sitting out in the corridors. And so then we decided that where there were a large number of white students, that's where the care went, that's where the books went, that's where the money went. Quoted in Freedom Bound. To ensure desegregated schools, local governments resorted to a policy known as busing, transporting children to schools outside their neighborhoods to achieve greater racial balance. The Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of busing in the 1971 case Swan versus Charlotte Mecklenburg Board of Education. Many whites responded to busing by taking their children out of public schools. Nearly 20,000 white students left Boston's public system for parochial and private schools. By late 1976, African Americans, Hispanics, and other minorities made up the majority of Boston's public school students. This white flight also occurred in other cities. New political leaders. In their struggle for equal opportunity, African Americans found new political leaders in people such as Jesse Jackson. In 1971, Jackson founded People United to Save Humanity, or PUSH, a group aimed at registering voters, developing African American businesses, and broadening educational opportunities. In 1984 and 1988, Jackson sought the Democratic presidential nomination. Although both attempts were unsuccessful, Jackson did win over millions of voters. African Americans also became significantly more influential in Congress. In 1971, African American members of Congress reorganized an existing organization into the Congressional Black Caucus in order to more clearly represent the legislative concerns of African Americans. The caucus formulated its own stance on important issues, especially health care, economic development, and crime. Reading check. Examining. What were the goals of affirmative action policies? Hispanic Americans organize. Hispanic Americans also worked for greater rights in this period. In 1960, about 3 million Hispanics lived in the United States. By the late 1960s, that number had increased to 9 million. Hispanics came to the United States from different places and for different reasons. Many Puerto Ricans migrated to eastern cities, particularly New York, to find jobs. Cubans often came to flee their country's communist regime. The largest Hispanic group was Mexican Americans, many of whom arrived during and after World War II to work on huge farms in the South and West. Hispanics often faced prejudice and limited access to adequate education, housing, and employment. Encouraged by the civil rights movement, they began to organize a protest movement. Cesar Chavez and the UFW. One notable Hispanic American campaign was the effort to win rights for farm workers. Most Mexican American farm laborers earned little pay, received few benefits, and had no job security. In the early 1960s, Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta organized two groups that fought for farm workers. In 1965, the groups cooperated in a strike against California growers to demand union recognition, increased wages, and better benefits. When employers resisted, Chavez enlisted college students, churches, and civil rights groups to organize a national boycott of table grapes, one of California's largest agricultural products. An estimated 17 million citizens stopped buying grapes, and several food store chains stopped selling them. Industry profits tumbled. Under the sponsorship of the American Federation of Labor and Congress of Industrial Organization, or AFL-CIO, in 1966, Chavez and Huerta merged their two organizations into one, the United Farm Workers, or UFW. The union's combined strength ensured that the boycott would continue. The boycott ended in 1970, when the grape growers finally agreed to a contract to raise wages and improve working conditions. Growing political activism. Hispanic Americans became more politically active during the 1960s and 1970s. In 1969, Jose Angel Gutierrez organized a new political party in Texas called La Raza Unida, or United People. In conjunction with similar organizations in Colorado and California, the group mobilized Mexican-American voters behind a political agenda that called for job training programs and greater access to financial institutions. In the 1970s, the party demonstrated significant strength at the polls. During this period, a growing number of Hispanic youths actively promoted their culture. In March 1968, about 1,000 Mexican-American students and their teachers at an East Los Angeles high school walked out of their classrooms to protest racism. One issue both Hispanic students and political leaders promoted was bilingualism, the practice of teaching immigrant students in their own language while they also learned English. Many Hispanics argued that they would be at a competitive disadvantage with native English speakers unless they had schooling in their native language. Congress supported their arguments, passing the Bilingual Education Act in 1968. This directed school districts to set up classes for immigrants in their own language as they were learning English. In recent years, there has been some movement away from bilingualism in states with large Hispanic populations. Some educators argue that total immersion in English is the soundest road to educational success. Some American voters opposed bilingual education, believing it makes it more difficult for a child to adjust to American culture than it was costly besides. The U.S. Supreme Court, however, upheld bilingualism in 1974. Reading check. Explaining, how did Hispanic Americans increase their economic opportunities in the 1960s? Native Americans raised their voices. Native Americans in 1970 were one of the nation's smallest minority groups, constituting less than 1% of the U.S. population. Few minority groups, however, had more justifiable grievances than the descendants of America's original inhabitants. The average annual family income of Native Americans was $1,000 less than that of African Americans. The Native American unemployment rate was 10 times the national rate. Joblessness was particularly high on reservation lands, where nearly half of all Native Americans lived. Most urban Native Americans suffered from discrimination and from limited education and training. The bleakest statistic of all showed that life expectancy among Native Americans was almost 7 years below the national average. To improve conditions, many Native Americans began organizing in the late 1960s and 1970s. A protest movement emerges. In 1961, more than 400 members of 67 Native American groups gathered in Chicago to discuss ways to address their numerous problems. They issued a manifesto known as the Declaration of Indian Purpose, calling for policies to create greater economic opportunities on reservations. Unlike other groups demanding more assimilation into mainstream society, many Native Americans wanted greater independence from it. They took a step toward this goal in 1968, when Congress passed the Indian Civil Rights Act. It guaranteed reservation residents the protections of the Bill of Rights, but it also recognized the legitimacy of local reservation law. Native Americans who viewed the government's reform efforts as too modest formed more militant groups, such as the American Indian Movement, or AIM. Typically, such groups employed a more combative style. In 1969, AIM made a symbolic protest by occupying the abandoned federal prison on Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Bay for 19 months, claiming ownership by right of discovery. A more famous and violent protest occurred later that winter at Wounded Knee, South Dakota, where federal troops had killed hundreds of Sioux in 1890. In February 1973, AIM members seized and occupied the town of Wounded Knee for 70 days. They demanded radical changes in the administration of reservations and that the government honor its long-forgotten treaty obligations to Native Americans. A brief clash between the occupiers and the FBI killed two Native Americans and wounded several on both sides. Shortly thereafter, the siege came to an end. Native Americans make notable gains. The Native American movement fell short of achieving all its goals, but it did win some notable victories. In 1975, Congress passed the Indian Self-Determination and Educational Assistance Act, which increased funds for Native American education and expanded local control in administering federal programs. More Native Americans also moved into policymaking positions at the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and the agency pushed for more Native American self-determination. Through the federal court system, Native Americans also won a number of the land and water rights they sought. The Pueblo of Taos, New Mexico, regained property rights to Blue Lake, a place sacred to their religion. In 1980, a federal court settled a claim of the Passamaquoddy and the Penobscot groups. The government paid the groups $81.5 million to relinquish their claims on land in the state of Maine. The two groups purchased 300,000 acres with the money and invested much of the remainder. Other court decisions gave Native American groups authority to impose taxes on businesses on their reservations and to perform other sovereign functions. Since Native Americans first began to organize, many reservations have dramatically improved their economic conditions by actively developing businesses such as electric plants, resorts, cattle ranches, and oil and gas wells. More recently, gambling casinos have become a successful enterprise. Because of rulings on sovereignty, Native Americans in some areas are allowed to operate gaming establishments under their own laws, even though state laws prevent others from doing so. In these ways, Native Americans have tried to regain control of their economic future, just as other American minorities did in the 1960s and 1970s. Reading check. Analyzing. What conditions led Native Americans to organize in the 1960s? Study and writing skill builder. Analyzing primary sources. Why learn this skill? To determine what happened in the past, historians do some detective work. They comb through bits of evidence from the past to reconstruct events. These bits of written and illustrated historical evidence are called primary sources. Learning the skill. Primary sources are records of events made by the people who witnessed them. They include letters, diaries, photographs, news articles, and legal documents. Primary sources yield several important kinds of information. Often they give detailed accounts of events. However, the account reflects only one perspective. For this reason, you must examine as many perspectives as possible before drawing any conclusions. To analyze primary sources, follow these steps. Identify the author of the source. Identify when and where the document was written. Read the document for its content and try to answer the 5W questions. Who is it about? What is it about? When did it happen? Where did it happen? Why did it happen? Determine what kind of information may be missing from the primary source. Practicing the skill. The primary source that follows is a small part of a United States legal document. Read the source and then answer the questions. Title IV, Education Amendments of 1972, Section 1684, Blindness or Visual Impairment, Prohibition Against Discrimination. No person in the United States shall, on the grounds of blindness or severely impaired vision, be denied admission in any course of study by a recipient of federal financial assistance for any education program or activity, but nothing herein shall be construed to require any such institution to provide any special services to such person because of his blindness or visual impairment. 1. When was this document written? 2. Who is affected by this legal document? 3. What is the purpose of this legal document? 4. Why do you think this document was written? Applying the skill. Analyzing primary sources. Find a primary source from your past. A photo, a report card, an old newspaper clipping, or your first baseball card. Bring this source to class and explain what it shows about that time in your life. Glencoe's Skill Builder Interactive Workbook CD-ROM Level 2 provides instruction and practice in key social studies skills.